When it comes to hard work, there's one important rule. Pick the right tool for the right job. That's why Chevy offers a family of Silverado pickup trucks designed just for the job. Go to ChevyDriveChicago.com and put a Silverado in your toolbox.
Ask not
the Beatles.
Bozo Circus is on the air.
The president doesn't.
Sometimes you feel like
that
a...
That means that it is not illegal.
Sometimes you
tear
don't...
Tear down this wall.
Here's Jenning!
Hey, Luke. May the force be with you.
It was you, Kristen, who shot J.R.
I did not have sexual relations with that woman.
Oh, we're not gay! Not that there's anything wrong with that.
John hasn't been waiting a long time to take the reins.
My name is Dave Letterman. Last night, I became a father. Thank you very much.
Today, Apple is going to reinvent the phone.
George W. Bush, and I approve this message.
For the third time in six seasons, it's one goal achieved. The Chicago Blackhawks win the Stanley Cup. The Blackhawks win the Stanley Cup.
It's in time. And the Chicago Cubs win the World Series. The Cubs have done it.
And now, this is history.
You're going to need outstanding hosts.
With Dave Plyer.
It's a guy, but I love you.
And Dave Schwann on 720 WGN.
1898, Will Kellogg invented cornflakes. That was like really one of the earliest cereals. I think it was an accident when he created this, if you remember, right?
Yeah.
So it goes back to the late 19th century. Seventh-day Adventists began to develop a new food to adhere to the vegetarian diet recommended by the church, and members of the group experimented with a number of different grains, including wheat, oats, rice, barley, and corn. In 1894, Dr. John Harvey Kellogg, superintendent of the Battle Creek Sanitarium in Michigan, and an Adventist, used these recipes as part of a strict regimen, which also included no alcohol, no tobacco, no... How would you survive on no alcohol, tobacco, or caffeine in this country?
Caffeine right in front of me.
Yeah. This idea for cornflakes began by accident when Kellogg's and his younger brother, Will Kellogg, left some cooked wheat to sit while they attended to some pressing matters at the sanitarium. When they returned, they found that the wheat had gone stale. But being on the strict budget, and they decided to continue to process it by forcing it through the rollers to flatten it, hoping to obtain long sheets of it, like doughy sheets of it, and they let it dry. And what they found instead, once they ran it through the roller, were these crunchy flakes. And this was in 1894, and then they patented really the very next year and took it to the public.
What was the name of the movie where the Kellogg people... Roger, are you there?
Yes, I am, and I was just thinking of it when Dave was talking about it, and I remember it was because they were on such a health kick that the cornflakes was not really what they were into. It was like an extra side thing, but it was a cleansing place that they really very strict cleansing, body cleansing issues.
It was a place where you took the cure, as they say.
Yeah.
How about a classic cornflakes commercial?
Glad you stopped by for breakfast, Jimmy. Oh, excuse me a moment, will you?
Ooh, it's Superman.
Hey, Mr. Kent, you're out of Kellogg's cornflakes. Look at the cupboard. There's a spare package.
That's awesome. Early
50s. You mean there was a spare package?
So that's where
you
guys
are. Kellogg's
cornflakes.
Because we got to get to the office. There's no time. Who do you think I am? Superman?
No. No, I don't think that.
Out of Kellogg's cornflakes. Fine host he is.
Even if Superman did deliver Kellogg's cornflakes, he'd have a tough time keeping everybody happy. More people run out of them every morning than any other cereal. Because Kellogg's cornflakes taste best to more people. Always have, still do. Don't run out at your house. Remember, anytime...
Great to have Superman as your spokesman.
How about that?
The Road to Wellville.
That's
was the name of the movie.
And that was
Roger.
About the Kellogg family?
Yes.
It was about the Santa the Road to Wellville. What year was it?
1994, comedy drama, film adaptation of a novel of the same name, tells the story of the doctor and clean living advocate John Harvey Kellogg and his methods.
I didn't know that was a recent
employed
movie.
At the Battle Creek Sanitarium.
Road to Wellville. Thank you.
Road
Thank
to Wellville. All right, my favorite cartoon character was... debuted in 1940. It is Bugs Bunny. That's really to me, that's the Ray Rayner theme, by the way.
Sure.
Even though it's Warner Brothers.
Sure. Yeah.
It was
and
a
the, well, because he played the cartoons.
Also.
Well, and it was his theme, too.
Yeah. Also, the little music that was used in Blazing Saddles with the candy gram from Mongo.
Oh, yes.
That's right.
Candy gram.
It was a
Mongo.
It was a Merry Melodies animated short film that was
Candy Graham playing it,
and I'm going to keep doing it. July 27, 1940, Wild Hair was the first official Bugs Bunny Park cartoon. The title is a play on wild hair, the first of many puns between hair, H-A-R-E, and hair, H-A-I-R. He's unnamed in the film.
And he doesn't look then like he looks
he
now.
Doesn't. No, yeah. He doesn't.
The rabbit had no name?
No, he didn't. And neither did Elmer Fudd. He didn't look like himself either.
No,
it was a different Elmer Fudd.
The first one?
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
how
look at that.
How things evolve. The early Popeye stuff was very different from the later ones.
And, of course, Mel Blanc did all those great voices.
The one and only.
Here's a short clip of Mel Blanc on David Letterman, which I loved when he was on that show because David actually really did revere, you know, some of the actors and comedians from the past, and have Mel Blanc on there was pretty cool. He was the voice of so many. Let's take a listen.
How do you go about creating a voice? Do you get a voice and then say, draw something to go along with this, or do they come to you and say...
They show me a picture of the character, and then they say, they show me a storyboard, which shows what the character is going to do in the cartoon. From this, I have to create the voice. Like Bugs, they said, was a tough little stinker. So I thought, which is the toughest voice in this country, the Brooklyn or the Bronx?
So you put the two of them together. That's how I got the voice for Bugs, Doc.
Isn't that great?
And I love that. You know how long he did the voice?
Oh, till his death.
49 years.
Wow. Wow. And then I think his son took it over, I guess, for some shorts and stuff.
Yeah.
You could tell in the when they were doing some TV specials that Bugs didn't quite, he was sounding not older, but a little slower in his cadence and so forth. But still.
He also did Barney Rubble.
Yes, he did. One of the Barney Rubbles.
Yeah.
And he, on Saturday mornings, my son still, you know, it's 7 o'clock in the morning, which I'm okay with because I need a nap at night on Saturday nights. He comes, you know, crawling into bed and, Dad, can we watch Looney Tunes? So, I mean, most kids don't know what Saturday morning cartoons are anymore.
I know.
Because there isn't on any of the networks or anything. That is a thing of the past. But the fact that he comes in there, I know they're on from like 5 to 7 a.m., so I DVR them every Friday night, Saturday morning, so that when he gets in there, we can
watch
it.
So you can watch him.
Absolutely.
Oh,
and I'll watch at least an hour with him. I mean, we'll hang out. At some point, my laptop will open up, but yeah, we watch a little Bugs Bunny. 1900. You remember this, Roger? The hamburger was created by Louis Lansing in Connecticut. Louis' Lunch advertises itself as the first restaurant to serve hamburgers and as being the oldest hamburger restaurant still operating in the U.S. as a small lunch wagon. It opened in 1895. It was also one of the first places in the U.S. to serve steak sandwiches.
According to Louis, it wasn't a hamburger until I told him to get a couple of pieces of bread and put it in between.
You were a smart man. You were a very smart man. 1957, Jack Parr's Tonight Show premieres. He was the second host of the Tonight Show, first being
Steve Allen.
Steve Allen, that's right. In 1954, let's listen to Jack, a little Jack Parr's Tonight Show.
This guy called his wife from his office, and she said, "Darling, I'm in the bathtub, and I'm standing here shivering. I'm in the nude, and let me finish the bath, and I'll call you back in 10 minutes." So the guy ran to his friend, who knew the girl, in his office. He said, "Call my wife right away," and he gave the setup. So the friend called, and there he gets here. He says, "Hello, Helen. This is Mort." "Helen, good grief, you're naked."
That's awesome. I love that. And he quit the Tonight Show famously, of course, too.
Yeah.
He walked away from it.
Had enough.
Yeah.
1965, President Lyndon B. Johnson signs a bill requiring cigarette makers to print health warnings on cigarette packages. He was a big smoker. Lyndon Johnson.
Well, yeah, a number of heart attacks.
Later.
Everybody was back then.
I mean, I still remember going over to my grandparents' house for a sleepover and coming home smelling like they, my mother would have to wash my clothes. I'd have to take a shower.
Right? Oh, yeah.
It was True Blues that he smoked.
True Blues.
Yeah. And you know what's funny? They stopped making it years ago, but I went to, I think it was in North Carolina, and there was like this massive warehouse of cigarette and cigar place, and they had a it was like almost like a warehouse, and they still had a case of True Blues. So I bought them and gave them to all my cousins because in honor of Grandpa.
Yeah, I think they used a plastic filter.
They might have
on the True Blues.
I remember the shape of the filter because it was in all the
of them
prints.
Had a plastic filters. Yeah.
A couple of them did, and it depended on the cut of it. Like some had a square, some had a triangle on the end.
Right.
Both my parents smoked.
Oh, yeah.
One smoked Winston's. The other smoked Marlboro.
Yes.
And for many, many, many years, they would smoke. And then Dad had his heart attack and had to stop. This was back in the mid to late 60s. And then Mom, I think, stopped shortly thereafter.
You know, if you were to follow a busy doctor as he makes his daily round of calls,
doctors love cigarettes.
You'd find yourself having a mighty busy time keeping up with him. Time out, for many men of medicine, usually means just long enough to enjoy a cigarette. And because they know what a pleasure it is to smoke a mild, good-tasting cigarette, they're particular about the brand they choose. In a repeated national survey, doctors in all branches of medicine, doctors in all parts of the country were asked, "What cigarette do you smoke, doctor?" Once again, the brand named most was Camel.
All right, now this weekend, we are also celebrating the 50th anniversary of the Apollo 11 moon landing. Buzz Aldrin was there, and I spoke to this American icon back in 2016 and asked him about his first steps on the moon. I have to ask you right off the bat, because I find this fascinating. Your mother's maiden name, by fate or coincidence, was Marion Moon.
Well, there are no coincidences, but I don't think... my father was particularly directed by some inner, outer, whatever, toward my mother. She was just an attractive preacher's daughter in the Philippines. And he happened to be in the Philippines, too. So.
Very cool. And your father was a career military man himself.
Pretty much. He started out, of course, as a pretty... ambitious Swedish young kid up in New England, and went to Clark University, and his physics professor was Robert Goddard.
Wow.
All right. That was inspirational.
Sure.
So he got his master's degree at Worcester Polytech, then started at MIT. The World War I beckoned a little bit, but a little bit too late, but he... changed from the Coast Artillery to the Signal Corps, because that's where they had airplanes. And his doctoral work at MIT was interrupted by his first assignment over to the Philippines as an aide to Billy Mitchell, later General Billy Mitchell, court-martialed for showing people how to dive bomb to sink battleships. Because that was against the rules.
Uh-huh, yeah.
But then he participated in many activities, started the Air Corps Engineering School in Dayton, Ohio, that later became the Air Force Institute of Technology that financed my Doctor of Science degree at MIT in manned orbital rendezvous.
So you can see right there where your inspiration obviously came from was your father.
Well, certainly his actions in the achievements in academics applied to a exciting new evolving aeronautical sciences that branched out to become the astronautics department at MIT.
Well, and you first went to West Point, too. You served as a jet fighter pilot in the Korean War yourself, and thank you for your service. You were an aide to the dean at the U.S. Air Force Academy, graduated from Squadron Officer School. You earned your Doctor of Science degree in astronautics. What got you interested, though, into exploring space?
Well, probably Buck Rogers and Flash Gordon.
That's cool. Yeah.
And all the talk about science fiction. And the Martians coming to the U.S. when I was about 8 or 9 years old. that's when that radio program with Orson Welles was on.
Yeah, War of the Worlds,
I mean, that excites your curiosity.
Absolutely does.
I don't think they're big snakes or pythons there, but I'll let someone else figure out whether there are canals or whether that's kind of like the moon with craters and mountains and so forth at Mars.
Well, I would say my kids have interest in space exploration a little bit from watching Buzz Lightyear, which from Toy Story is honorably named after you. Where did you get the nickname Buzz from?
Lunar Larry was not a good, wholesome name applied to this spaceman.
Mm-hmm.
So they decided that a more exciting name, maybe.
Okay.
So we looked over the name of real guys, and it became Buzz Lightyear.
That's great. I love that. I love that. Well, you know, back in 66, you selected as an astronaut, Gemini 12, Apollo 11, 1969, alongside Neil Armstrong, almost 50 years ago, you landed on the moon. That still must be, to this day, one of the most incredible experiences of your life. What part of that trip feels like it was yesterday, the most memorable?
I imagine the most memorable is the most important, which wasn't watching out my window while Neil went down the ladder or backing down the ladder myself. It was touching down on the surface of what became the Sea of Tranquility. And we had done just what the president had asked us to do, send a man to the moon and bring him back safely. Now, that was a good final phrase. We liked that, but we decided, or not we, someone, let's send two people there.
Mm-hmm.
And let's look around while we're there, and after landing, let's not only look around, let's get out and go around. So, symbolic things become very important. Getting down the ladder and putting your foot on the ground, ooh, that's important. But also, urinating in your spacesuit, being the first person to do that.
Right, right.
That's not quite as famous.
I would think it doesn't sound as fun.
You got to give credit where credit is due.
Sure, absolutely.